Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We're in the first hour of our program this morning. We were considering something that I just thought was a story on world events and turned out to be a treatise on fulfilled prophecy, as we find the Ukrainians, who are in such a desperate position, having been openly hostile to Jews, attacking them over time and over and over and over again, killing many hundreds of them. And that was just the first of many pogrom attacks against the Jewish community. Fascinating. And we will return on Monday to that story. During the time that we were speaking of Noah and the religious conditions that existed in and around Eden, which would be in eastern Turkey, where God said that the mentality and the attitude of people became wholly despicable, that they became religious, that they became militant. They formed political entities that were corrupt, and that they perpetrated the same kind of terror on people, robbing them, that we witnessed in these pogroms in the Ukraine. And that it is this tendency of human behavior to savage one another, to rob one another, to terrorize one another, to mutilate one another, to murder one another, that Yahweh said is so despicable, I need to cleanse the region of this of these religiously inspired elements. Now, with that in mind, I received an email this morning. It may have come in last night, but in this morning's mail, as I was going through my emails, from a listener's name is Chad in Kentucky, about a site that has been recently discovered in eastern Turkey. And so I have both Larry on the line here and Chad, who has called in. And let's talk a little bit about what has been found by archaeologists. Hello, Chad. Welcome to Shattering Myths.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, why don't you talk a little bit about this particular site, where it's located and what has been found and what its implications are for the story we were reviewing relative to Yahweh's disdain for the people that were living around the Garden of Eden.
Well, from the research I've done on the web, Göbekli Tepe, the scientists claim it was buried 10,000 years ago on purpose, covered with rubble to preserve it. And there's carvings of animals on the stones there, and some of the animals that are carved on the stones no longer live in that region anymore. So I thought it was interesting, and my email to you was basically, how do you think this relates to Noah's flood? Because apparently whoever buried this knew the flood was coming.
Yeah, it's also interesting, Chad, that the remains that we find there, most of it, most of the structures are religious. The things that make it interesting is that these carvings are on upright pillars that are all arranged in circular arrays. So, you know, if you look at almost all of the pagan religions of yesteryear, they all arrange things in a like Stonehenge that are round, and they're all oriented towards in conjunction with the movement of the sun, the moon, and the stars around the Earth's ecliptic. And so, this was principally a religious site. There are people that live there, but the remains are all religious, and you're right. They buried it. They knew that that something horrible was happening, and it's just fascinating that the primary carvings on these vertical stone pillars arranged in the round, and that things are in the round because guess who the primary god was of all pagan religions.
Would that be
the sun? The sun. No, the primary god who was always the sun. Now, the sun, like Nimrod, was thought to be from Ninus, meaning sun. Ninus was the son of the sun. And so all pagan religions, the primary god is the sun, and the moon is typically the queen of heaven and the mother of the gods, but so is Mother Earth. And Ninus or Nimrod was the son of the sun, which would be Tammuz also in Babylon. It would be Osiris in the Greek and the Egyptian religion. It would be Dionysus in the Greek religion, Bacchus in the Roman religion. In fact, Christianity is based almost entirely on the myths associated with Dionysus, the son of the sun. But so here you have these pillars all arranged in a circular fashion. All of the energy of the people was directed towards the religion. Now, you have to be coerced to do that. For people to have been forced, compelled, encouraged, should we use that term, to carry all of these huge stones into place and to erect them, at a time when just surviving would have been a challenge. To make this religious shrine on in an inhospitable place tells you that religion and politics and militarism and economics had all joined together to have an enormous influence, let's say control, over the people. Exactly the kind of thing that Yahweh was depicting. But beyond that, as you've noted, the thing that is most interesting about the carvings on these things is they're filled with animals. And many of the animals no longer exist in the region. And there's no history of many of those animals existing in the region. So it sure does look like it's another affirmation of the flood. Now, but even more, it's an affirmation of what God said. And this site is in eastern Turkey. It's, it's not all that far from Lake Van. It's just south of it. And so we are... seeing here proof that what God was describing as the mess that had become of humanity, religious, political, militaristic, and economic monsters, that's what existed here. That's the only way that you could compel people who were striving to survive to build this religious shrine in this inhospitable place. That's what I get out of the excavation of it. What do you think?
No, I agree with everything you said. It's something I've been looking into for the past year, and I think what you said there covered it well, and I don't really have anything else to add. I appreciate it.
Certainly. I appreciate you you calling in. I would encourage people to Google it. It is GOBEKLI, second word, TEPE. And if you do, what you'll find is the round nature of the arrangement of all of these stones, the very sophisticated carving of the stones of all of the animals that are shown is really as religious objects on the stone, the location in a very inhospitable place. And then what I think makes the most sense is to do what you've done. Okay, here's a bit of knowledge that we can glean. What does this tell us? And when your perspective is the Torah, I think that what it tells us is that people to do this kind of thing, to invest this kind of energy into erecting something that would have required generations of work and enormous labor, had to be highly motivated and controlled by their religion, had to be compelled by politics and militarism to do this. In other words, to not participate had to be catastrophic. And what I see here is the very conditions that manifest themselves and have throughout history when militarism, economics, politics, and religion have merged as a singular force to control people. And this is a legacy of it, and it sounds to me like this, and it's the place where it was, the timing that it existed, is proof that Yahweh was telling us the truth about why he wanted to wipe these people out.
Yeah, they had some interesting names too, didn't they, Ghana?
Yes, they did.
Like, yeah, run rings around God, stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wow. And of course, you know, the pillars are always erected vertical, as they are in Stonehenge, because reflect the last and the first rays of light. You know, I was driving across the country this past weekend, and early in the morning, about 6 o'clock in the morning, as I was driving from St. George, Utah, approaching Las Vegas, as the sun was yet not on the horizon, just coming up on the horizon, the only thing that was lit is the mountains. Everything else was still dark, but the mountains began to glow. And it's the very same thing that man is trying to create, these pillars, where at the first light of day and the last light of day, they glow as if, you know, they're magically illuminated. It creates a religious aura. And that's why they do these kinds of things. And as you notice, that everything was round. And this round, by the way, by Chad and Larry, as you both know, has followed its way right into Christianity. The halos in Christianity based upon this. Yeah, church. Church is based upon church and churchte, which speaks of circular and round. It's the goddess daughter of the sun and the Teutonic. Helos and the Teutonic religion. And, you know, if you look at Christianity, you'll see sunbursts everywhere. If you look at a lot of the European crosses, they have a circular sun disk superimposed on the cross. If you look at
halos.
Yeah, you look at a Catholic church, what you will see is, I mean, just examine the religious furniture in a Catholic church, and you'll see sunbursts and sun-depicted objects everywhere.
You look at drenched in pagan idolatry and sun worship. I mean,
right,
period.
Yeah. Yeah, you look at even at Christmas. What do you think the wreath is that we put on outside
the
door? Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. It's an amazing thing that people think they're going to please the Creator God, who told us to stay away from all these pagan things, by just drenching themselves in it. Yeah. And of course, what it does is separates them completely.
Right.
From him.
Yeah, Chad, you had a comment?
Isn't the root word for church also the same root word for circus?
Yes, it is. Yeah. The reason that circus and circle are related is that the first circles, circuses were performed in circular rings, and so the circular ring became the name for circus. But it is the basis of the English word church, which we get from the Germanic nations. We'll return to Shattering Myths after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. There's a little bit more I'd like to share on the Göbekli Tepe find. The first of those is that continuing to study what has been provided by Wikipedia in this matter, let me just read this. It says, so far, very little evidence for residential use has been found. What we know is that the people who erected this were hunter-gatherers. As a hunter-gatherer, I mean, you're really devoted. You devote most of your energy to survival. And this was not a residential community. There is no evidence thus far of any significant numbers of people living here. What it says, very little evidence. There may have been some priests, but that's it. So, to create something like this means that there had to be complete control over the population. And that control, it had to be religious, had to be political, had to be militaristic, had to be economic. A combination of all of those factors to get them to devote such enormous energy to creating this massive site. It's what we've already uncovered is massive in its proportions. And we've only uncovered 5% of it. Now, there's a couple of other things I want to share on it. The relief on the vertical columns depict the following characters, and I want to share them because of their the proximity of these same characters in the reliefs, the religious reliefs that we find in Babylon. The first is they depict lions. The winged lion was the primary symbol of Babylon, and it represented a their god, a winged lion. So, lions, bulls. The bull has always been a principal symbol for religion, because the sun crosses the constellation of Taurus, the bull, during the spring equinox, where the days and nights are equal of length, and that is the reason for the pagan symbol of the cross. It's reason for the image of the bull in religious artifacts. So the bull was the second most common depiction in these religious shrines. Boars. Now, the boar is important because of Tammuz and Nimrod, and the fact that he was allegedly killed by a wild boar, and that the Easter ham became the principal meal. And the boar is when idolized in this fashion, is the antithesis of God's instruction to don't eat swine. Foxes were there because they're clever. Donkeys, and then, of course, snakes and reptiles. In fact, the most ornate and detailed depictions are of snakes and reptiles, which has always been a symbol of Hasatan, the adversary. He slithered into the garden as a snake. Now, there was also birds of prey. Yahweh specifically tells us don't eat vultures. And yet, vultures were the principal depictions. Now, here's another interesting aspect of Göbekli Tepe. It says some of the T-shaped pillars have human arms carved on their lower half, suggesting that they are intended to represent the bodies of stylized humans, or perhaps gods, or perhaps humans depicted as gods. Loincloths also appear on the lower half of a few pillars. The horizontal stone member on the top is thought to symbolize a human head. The pillars as a whole refer to an anthropomorphic identity. Whether they were intended to serve as surrogate worshippers, symbolize venerated ancestors, or represent the supernatural, the anthropomorphic beings are depicted throughout this shrine. Now, it's also interesting that as I traveled through the USSR back in the time that it was communist, one of the things that I found, and I found the same thing in communist China when I was amongst the first Westerners allowed into China after Nixon opened up travel. And what you saw was Mao Zedong, you saw Lenin and Marx, and others depicted as if they were gods. Their features became chiseled, and they were depicted in stone as well as on billboards with their sayings cited as if they were scripture. This idea of depicting men as gods has been around a very long time. It is what happened in the Soviet Union. It still exists in China. It is precisely what is being depicted in North Korea today, and it was evident all the way back before the time of Noah. We'll return to Shattering Myths after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I want to just to say on this this topic of the shrine that has been discovered in eastern Turkey, that there's a lot more that we would do ourselves justice by investing time to study. One of the things that I was learned during this commercial break is that those who have been studying the shrine recognize that it was based upon what we term now shamanism. And shamanism is the practice that involves a practitioner reaching an altered state of consciousness in order to encounter and interact with the spirit world and to channel these transcendental energies into this world. A shaman is a person regarded to having access to and influence in the world of benevolent and malevolent spirits who typically enters into a trance during a ritual and practices divination. This is the scientific report out of this archaeological discovery in Göbekli Tepe. As a matter of fact, here's just a comment. Schmidt, who's the principal observer, related the scientist writing about this site. He says that he's engaged in trying to understand the belief systems of the groups that created the Göbekli Tepe site based on comparisons with other shrines and settlements. He has come to the conclusion that shamanic practices existed there and suggests that the T-shaped pillars may represent mystical creatures, perhaps ancestors, where he sees a fully articulated belief in gods that developed later in Mesopotamia, associated with extensive temples and palaces. So this integration of a temple and a palace tells us that cleric and king were first united right here, outside of the walls of the Garden of Eden. He goes on to talk about ancestor worship, which we see today in Roman Catholicism, with their veneration of saints, and the depiction of gods using the human form. This combination of man and God as one. Just amazing how early on we became corrupt. What do you think, Larry?
Well, I think you're dead on the money. I think it was a lot of religious veneration going on there, and I'm not sure about their 10,000 years, but I don't know. You know, that could have been prior to Adam being expelled from the garden. You know, maybe.
Yeah, one of the things that is absolutely certain about this is that it is devastating to the Christian religious interpretation of Genesis, where Adam was the first man, and that the earth and mankind are just 6,000 years old.
Interestingly, I'm on a debate right now where they say they found a man with DNA 400,000 years old, which could be possible from what I know. And
the earliest example of Homo sapiens, I think, goes back about 100,000 years for Homo sapiens. They're found in a cave in northern Israel. But the hominid species has existed probably a matter of millions of years. And that's completely consistent with Yahweh's testimony. When you recognize what he has to say, one of the things that was just so fascinating is that God specifically tells us that outside of the garden there were civilizations, that there were cities, and that he spoke of the cities, and he spoke of the conditions that were taking place there, which is the kind of thing, when it's done on a broad scale, has to be the motivation of religion and politics and economics and militarism all being combined. And so the very fact that God says that there were cities and religious and military activity taking place outside of the garden, immediately upon the time that that Adam and Chawa were expelled, says they had been around for a very long time.
So, no doubt about that. I just, I'm just in this debate. You know, first of all, the Christians all come in and the earth is only 6,000 years old, you know, which is, of course, nonsense.
It's wholly inconsistent with Yahweh's testimony. You know, when you read Yahweh's testimony, the very first thing that strikes you is that he is providing a witness to creation as the creator.
From his perspective.
Right.
And that means it couldn't be calibrated by the earth's time clock. It had to be from his perspective. And we know, as we go backwards from this point towards creation, time slows appreciably to the final point where it comes to an almost complete stop, because the more dense an object is and the more hot an object is, the quicker the light wave, but the shorter. Right. So time does not stretch.
Right.
And the problem, you know, 15 billion years his time, or our time, is 6 days his time. He's still on the sixth day. That's what people don't get.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, all of these the studies, and particularly the Wilkinson probe recently, that is designed to measure the stretching of the wavelength from the residue of the Big Bang, shows us that time has slowed 10 to the 12th power since the Big Bang. And that means that, do the math, that 14 to 15 billion years from our perspective looking back is exactly 6 days from the perspective of a witness to creation. And so the answer is all there. God then presents not only the term Big Bang, coins the term Big Bang in terms of his creation. He actually talks about the order of events that that transpired over the great time of creation in the right order, in the all the way through. And you even when you recognize,
he even talks about water creating planets. You know,
right?
I mean, really, and he mentions relativity four times.
Right.
You know, and yet you get people that just want to, well, 6 days means 6 days my time, and so I live in a fairy tale in La La Land, and I don't even really look at science nor care about it. If they would just investigate, they would find out scientifically Yahweh was way ahead, you know,
500
years
ago. Imagine this. If you go back 75 years ago, virtually all scientists believed that the universe was a constant. Even Einstein believed that the universe was a constant.
Expanding.
But Yahweh said it was expanding, and the thing that caused scientists to concur with Yahweh that the universe was created and expanding is the Hubble's recognition of the redshift, where when light is moving away from you, it appears more red. When it is moving towards you, it appears more blue. And so Hubble, by examining the redshift, our perception of the light, as opposed to the light doesn't change, it's just our perception of the light from our vantage point, he recognized the universe was expanding. If it's expanding, it had to have had a genesis, a creation, and so science has now come to concur with Yahweh. But this redshift is the same thing as we notice in the microwave background radiation that is the stretching of the light wave. It was the same when it was conceived. It's just a marker of how the perception and the flow of time has changed from the conditions experienced in the Big Bang to now. And so when you realize how brilliant Yah's and accurate Yah's testimony is regarding creation, and then how stupid and erroneous the Christian depiction is, it's no wonder that that a lot of scientists, a lot of agnostics and atheists are agnostics and atheists, not because they have an argument with God. They actually agree with him. They just don't know it. It's just that there is this myth that religions define God, and since the religions are all wrong, scientists are basing their concept of God based upon the religious myths and therefore rejecting them. And one of them they would reject is this Christian notion that the universe is 6,000 years old.
There was an atheist that jumped in and said he was proud that he came from apes. And I said, well, you know, but he believed in science. And I said, well, if you believed in science, you'd believe in Mendel's law, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would.
You know, you can't magically create genetic code. It can only be lost. It can't be gained.
Right.
And
it's one of the most amazing things is that if you actually believed science, you'd recognize that macroevolution is impossible.
Impossible.
And you'd also understand the facts that the Cambrian explosion proved emphatically that what Yahweh said is true, that he conceived life. And
everything came right on the planet at one time.
At the same time. Every body form came to exist at the exact same time. They didn't slowly evolve through billions of years from a very...
I knew that was nonsense. You know, I was raised an atheist, and I thought, well, you know, why don't you have a half cricket, half grasshopper, you know, whichever is higher on the evolutionary scale? I don't know.
Yeah.
But you don't have any of these half-formed anythings
anywhere in any
fossil record. And I said, well, so this can't be true, you know. And of course, it isn't true because that's not how things work. And by the way, why would you stop? Say you're a worm.
Yes.
You know, and you're going to climb up to be a man or whatever. why do you stay a worm?
Right.
Why are there any worms left?
Right. Yeah, there is.
You know, you decided to maintain your wormness. That doesn't make sense either.
No, the fiction is brilliant. What's interesting, too, is that Yahweh actually gives us two presentations of creation. Which is, and it trips up people. That's how they've come to believe that there are four different authors of the Torah. Is because he actually gives us two depictions of creation. The first is the opening, presentation of creation, which is creation from his perspective. The second is actually creation from man's perspective, from our perspective. And so he provides us with both perspectives, both of which are useful, interesting, enlightening, and yet Christians and religious people the world over have completely misinterpreted what God has had to tell us. We'll return to Shattering Myths after the commercials. Welcome back to the final segment of Shattering Myths for today. Chad has taken us in the direction of scriptural verifications, and I think we'll just stay with that topic with you, Larry. One of the things that strikes me is that we talk about the nature of life. One of the things that we have learned quite recently is that life is based upon DNA. And DNA is a alphabet. It is a form of written communication. The only difference between a alphabet that is used to write books and the alphabet of life is that DNA is a three-dimensional communication or alphabet. Language. And so it is when you, the difference between two dimensions and three dimensions is essentially infinite, by the way, in terms of what you can accomplish. It's like the difference between a drawing of Mickey Mouse and Walt Disney, Mickey's creator, is the difference between two and three dimensions. Human languages and alphabets are all two-dimensional constructs, while DNA is a three-dimensional language. Larry, what do you think the odds are that a language came to being without an author?
Zero.
Zero. You know what is not depicted anywhere in this massive shrine, religious edifice in eastern Turkey. What isn't found on any one of the stones anywhere in the in this religious site?
I'm guessing Yahweh's not there.
Well, no, he's not there. What's not there is writing.
Oh yeah.
It's really interesting that if you look, mankind's greatest single achievement is written communication. Nothing even comes close to its significance in terms of human history. Here we have a religious shrine, but we have no writing. The earliest traces of writing are all almost immediately within 500 years of Adam and Chawa being deported from the garden. It's as if Yahweh bequeathed Adam and Chawa, the first humans that he created in his image, with the ability to communicate both orally and in writing. And God indicated this by providing a sign for Cain indicating that writing was coterminous with their expulsion from the garden. And what you find is that in history, throughout the world, the first examples of writing are within 500 years of the of 6,000 years ago when Adam and Chawa were booted from the garden, 4,000 BCE. So that tells me that, yeah, I don't have any problem with this shrine being 8,000 BCE. Or even 9,000 BCE.
50,000 BCE, for all I care. I mean,
yeah. I don't think it can probably be that far back, but it certainly could be that far back. And what it indicates is that, yes, the Homo sapiens species was into to religion and to the elevation of man to God and to control over populations for a very long time, and God got sick of it.
Well, you and I both know that there's a difference between nephesh and the sama.
Yes.
And everything has nephesh, a fish, a cat,
right.
A dog.
Right.
That's just a consciousness. And the gift that made Adam in Yahweh's image was he, first of all, and this is important, Yahweh knelt down, and
right.
So he's kneeling down to a man. He's not asking a man to kneel to him. And he breathed nesama into Adam. And
right.
That was then a living spirit, or the ability to make good decisions based
right.
on thought.
Right.
And prior to that, men did not have nesama. All they had was nephesh. And people
right.
with nesama went out and married people that only had nephesh, and they created monsters, and thus the flood, which is
right.
what you're talking right. about
right.
this week.
Now,
so.
Now, that's not to say that somebody with a nephesh, a conscience, a consciousness, can't think. You know, this morning I was.
He just doesn't make good decisions.
No, I mean, well, they're not reasoning, but they still can think. And when you have a nesama, now it doesn't mean that you're going to make good decisions, but at least you have the capacity to exercise good judgment, which is the whole purpose of free will. Yahweh wants us to come to know and understand who He is and what He's offering so we can make an intelligent decision about participating in His covenant. Thank you, Larry. We'll be back at this time tomorrow. May God bless you all.